I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE. The world stands on the brink of nuclear war after Genocide Joe permitted US weapons to directly target Russia, not only the largest country in the world, but the country with the largest number of nuclear weapons. Meanwhile, people are rising up in NATO nations against genocide today. In the capital of empire, beleaguered Biden's house is being surrounded by a symbolic red line to signal to the world the US political class's betrayal of all humanity in Gaza and Jerusalem. West Asian superpower Saudi Arabia, far from the lies coming from the US State Department about normalization with Israel, has denounced Israel for, quote, continuous genocidal massacres against Palestinians. Here, the UAE is deepening military collaboration with China amidst unfulfilled US promises and escalating Israeli aerial bombardment of Syria, of Lebanon, and of Yemen. Joining me now from Montreal, Canada, is Muin Rabbani, who worked with the UN in Syria and who now co-edits Jadilia magazine, created ahead of the Arab Spring. Thank you so much, Muin, for coming on. I've got to say, in Western European nations, the genocide has gone, or plausible genocide has gone, a bit quiet. They have more important things, the vassal states, as they're being called, it appears. What do you make, then, of Biden seeming to reheat a Hamas ceasefire plan, if anything, and insisting it's an Israeli plan, while supplying the ammunition and the bombs to behead children in Gaza?
Too bizarre for words. What you had is the US President Joe Biden publicly announcing what he stated was an Israeli ceasefire proposal. So the first question is, why is the US rather than Israel making this public? Subsequently, the Israelis denied it was their proposal. Then the Americans insisted. They basically put out precisely what they received from the Israelis. Then the Israelis tell the Americans, or leak to the press, that there were additional details that were not included. Now the Israelis are asking for U.S. guarantees that they can resume their genocidal onslaught once the deal is implemented. And in the meantime, as might well be expected, the Americans are insisting the onus is on Hamas to accept this, rather than first ensuring that Israel accepts what, by all accounts, is its own proposal that can then be put to the other party. It's really too bizarre for words, and it demonstrates once again what many, or at least what I've always concluded, that often in these situations, the U.S. is more pro-Israel than Israel itself.
And less pro-American, some might say. I mean, very little news we're hearing about these reports of the USS Eisenhower, this $670 million Northrop Grumman aircraft carrier, having to retreat to Jeddah because of resistance forces in the Red Sea. I mean, have you got any update on that, the attacks on the USS Eisenhower?
Not on that specific attack, but I think it's worth putting this in larger context, which is that one key issue driving U.S. diplomacy is that it seems to be stuck in a contradiction. On the one hand, it has thoroughly embraced Israel's genocidal war against the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. At the same time, it also appears determined to avoid further regional escalation. The obvious way to avoid further regional escalation is to end the genocide. But instead of doing that, the U.S. has been threatening Hezbollah in Lebanon, has been sending its naval task force to the Red Sea to seek to, unsuccessfully, I might add, as you've just indicated, put an end to Houthi missile attacks on shipping going through Bab al-Mandab. And we've even had direct confrontation for the first time since 1979, between Israel and Iran. So the U.S. on the one hand wants to prevent further escalation, but at the same time is driving further escalation, and at the same time is getting directly involved in this escalation itself. And of course, for Israel, the biggest prize would be a direct confrontation between the United States and Iran, which has appeared at some points increasingly likely, I think is now less likely, but does remain plausible unless and until this genocide ends.
Yeah, I don't know whether we can believe anything the Americans say, but they say the USS Eisenhower wasn't struck, but what did happen definitely in the past few days is that Britain and the United States aerially bombarded famine-hit Yemen, which is so sanctioned. Most Americans, though, I mean, regardless of whether this deal is to do with pleasing a base before November's election and whatnot, most Americans in the USA, according to polls, are against Israel now. It's today the anniversary of the 1949 publication of George Orwell's 1984. How is it, do you think, speaking from where you are in Canada, actually, that the NATO propaganda machine has not worked? I know that some say the TikTok ban was in part, and threats to ban it were in part, because of the youth using social media to discover what the lies were that are told to them about the genocide. Why has it not worked? Why are there so many people demonstrating today outside the White House and across Western Europe, in London, for instance, as many of them saw the pictures that CNN and Comcast, Sky News and the rest are not going to show, of children beheaded by NATO weapons?
I think there's multiple explanations for this. The obvious one is that you can only hide the sun with your finger for so long before you get sunburned. In Israel's case, I think it's fair to say that Israeli propaganda has had it too good for too long and has simply become lazy and complacent, and as a result, increasingly ineffective. For example, this week, the New York Times revealed that Israel was running a covert influence operation using social media against members of Congress, with a specific emphasis on African-American Democrats in Congress. But if you look at who its main targets were, not only was it preaching to the converted, but it was setting up bots, for example, with male names but female pictures, and all this. So completely ineffective. I think another aspect, of course, is that people, particularly younger people, are no longer solely reliant on mainstream media, whether television or print or digital, and have access to accurate information, very disturbing information, in real time. And then there's the additional factor that Israel, as a state and as a society, has moved so far to the right, and in many cases to the lunatic fringes, that it is simply incapable of generating the kind of propaganda that it did in previous decades, where it could at least pretend to appear reasonable, pretend to be genuinely interested in a peaceful resolution of the Arab-Israeli conflict and the question of Palestine. Because in today's Israeli environment, anyone who puts forth such propaganda about being reasonable and wanting peace and having genuine respect for others is basically committing political suicide. And so Israeli propaganda is increasingly too extreme to be palatable to Western audiences. And I think that's another factor.
Well, of course, the propaganda continues in American so-called mainstream press once the lie is first published, even though the New York Times, the Sulzberger family's newspaper, can apologize about the lies told about October 7th and fake sex crimes. But by then, too many people know about it. Did you hear about the gray zone being targeted by the Amazon Washington Post the other day? I know the gray zone was... people can watch our interview with Max Blumenthal in the studio here, the editor of Gray Zone, who has done so much to expose the lies coming from Israel and propaganda outlets in NATO countries. Did it surprise you that they were attacked directly by the Washington Post?
I'm frankly unaware of this specific issue, but on the whole, no, I'm not surprised. I mean, the mainstream press has a history of not only suppressing alternative viewpoints and suppressing dissent, but also attacking dissenters. I mean, we need only look at, for example, the U.S. Invasion of Iraq in 2003, where it was the New York Times and other leading newspapers and television stations that led the charge that completely inflated these false allegations about an Iraqi nuclear weapons program and WMD and so on. And you know, it's New York Times is not known as American Pravda for nothing. It performs a very similar role, perhaps using different means, but it performs the same role of confirming state policy, elite opinion, and all the rest of it. What Noam Chomsky, I think, quite aptly referred to as manufacturing consent. The problem now for the state and for these leading media corporations is that people have direct access to credible information in real time through alternative mechanisms. And so fewer and fewer people are relying on these agencies. And of those that do, there appears to be also greater skepticism about the news that they bring out than there have been in previous decades.
I should ask you, actually, given that, as you said, we know of congressmen that have been targeted, we know of international criminal court lawyers that have been targeted, and all sorts of horrific covert operations going on. Have you ever been targeted? Jadalia, your magazine, the Institute, for the things that you say?
Not that I'm aware of, and I think more importantly, it wouldn't have made a difference.
Well, having said all of this, Netanyahu has accepted an invitation to address Congress despite this international arrest warrant being sought against him. It would make him speaking more to Congress, addressing them more than Churchill. What do you think about him? I mean, I should say Biden this Thursday will be in Puglia for the G7, so I don't know. What do you think about him addressing Congress while the American people stand seemingly with Palestine, according to some polls?
Well, I think it's primarily a message to the U.S. administration, sending a clear message that Congress will act in Israel's interest rather than the American interest should it come to any policy clash between Washington and Israel. Going back to the ceasefire proposal that we were discussing at the outset, one motivation for Biden was really to go over Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu's head and appeal directly to the Israeli political class and Israeli public opinion. This is Netanyahu's response. You think you can go over my head? No, it is I who will go over your head by showing that I have Congress in my pocket. It's not in your pocket. And by making a direct appeal to U.S. elites and the U.S. political class to basically choose sides. And as we know, particularly in the increasingly polarized U.S. political system, and now it also being an election year and so on, I suspect that it will be Netanyahu rather than Biden who will come out on top.
Moin Rabbani, I'll stop you there. More from the co-editor of Jadalia and former UN Syria advisor after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with Moin Rabbani, co-editor of Jadalia. Moin, you were talking about Biden's tribulations and his not being in power, Netanyahu being in power, arguably. As regards the vassal states that are sending in the weapons and ammunition to behead babies in Gaza, what do you make of their behavior? Because the G7, I mean, does the G7 stand for genocide? Is that what the G stands for when they meet in Puglia in Italy on Thursday?
Well, that's certainly a very good characterization. I would, however, like to take issue with your description of the United States as Israel's vassal state. I think it's very much the other way around. I think Israel derives its strength from the support it gets from the U.S. because Washington sees it as a reliable and dependable and powerful bastion of Western interests in the Middle East. And if Israel was not believed to be performing this function, basically, it would not get the support of either the U.S. or the United Kingdom or the European Union. And I think one problem that Israel is now going to experience in the months and years to come is it's supposed to be this omnipotent, omniscient, all-powerful emissary of Western interests, a bastion of Western interests in the Middle East. But in the better part of a year, it couldn't even crush a second-order militia, Hamas, in a miniature postage stamp-sized territory, meaning the 365 square kilometers of the Gaza Strip. And I'll be very interested to learn in years to come whether, and I believe it will, whether this will affect the position of Israel in Western geopolitical and strategic thinking.
Or against what you said about, clearly they're not useful in terms of American security because they endanger American security, their existence. But $100 million from AIPAC this election cycle coming through now, why are they spending so much money buying an election manipulating in the United States then?
Well, I think the question that needs to be asked is why does AIPAC think it needs to spend all this money to maintain sufficient congressional
support? It's the way American democracy works, so-called democracy.
That's the way American plutocracy works. I'm not sure democracy is the appropriate term here. But, if you look back over the past few decades, I think it's fair to say that Israel's primary strategic assets, far and away, I think, more important than the arms deliveries and all the rest of it, has been the solid bipartisan U.S. political support for Israel and for its policies. And it's worth recalling that the mainstay of support for Israel in Congress and among the U.S. political elites used to be among liberal Democrats rather than conservative and evangelical and fringe Republicans. That's, of course, changed. But the more interesting development, in my view, is that Israel has become an increasingly partisan issue in U.S. politics. And the Democratic Party, for example, is increasingly divided over the issue of U.S. policy.
Not in Congress.
Well, even in Congress. I mean, you have the so-called squad. You have certain prominent senators demanding that their own government observe U.S. domestic legislation with respect to arms exports and so on.
Yeah, I never see them much on TV, this squad talking much.
Excuse me?
I never see this squad talking on TV about genocide or using the G word even that often.
Some do, some don't. But I think more importantly is these are people who are now openly and publicly dissenting from the U.S. consensus on blind support for Israel. It's a slow process. It's not going to result in policy changes, certainly not this week. But it shows, I think, the beginnings of a fracture in the solid bipartisan U.S. support that Israel has always enjoyed.
Obviously, it comes too late for the dead in Gaza.
Of course.
Today.
Of course.
I want to get on to the kind of punishment meted out on any country or any region that dares to defy this AIPAC, Israel lobby, this Zionist cyclops. What did you make about Britain and the USA bombing Yemen in the past few days then? Killing civilians.
Well, of course.
And not reporting, of course.
I think what's happening here is abundantly clear. Washington and London stood before a choice. They could either call a halt to Israel's genocidal onslaught on the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, as a result of which these attacks on shipping from Yemen would come to an end, or they could engage in the bombing and killings in Yemen in order to ensure that Israel would be able to continue with its genocidal onslaught in the Gaza Strip. And quite clearly, Washington and London have decided that enabling Israel's genocide in the Gaza Strip is more important than keeping the shipping lanes in the Red Sea open.
I'm sure lots of businesses watching this will wonder what on earth they're doing in that case. Meanwhile, Jake Sullivan, National Security Advisor, and Antony Blinken continue to talk about Saudi Arabian normalization with Israel. I mean, you might have to tell me why on earth they do that when we had Saudi Arabia quote, say, in the strongest terms, condemning the continuous, quote, genocidal massacres by Israeli occupation forces. Meanwhile, on US television, they keep talking about normalization. The thing is, can they not reactivate ISIS, Daesh, and Al-Qaeda forces like they used in Syria? Can they not do this again and attack the countries like Saudi Arabia? I mean, here the UAE has been saying that it's not got the F-35s from the Abraham Accords and is looking to increase cooperation with China. What punishment is going to be meted out to the Arab countries that are not supporting enough the US genocide?
Bear in mind, this is the same Jake Sullivan who published an article immediately before October 7th saying things have never been better in the Middle East. The region hasn't been this quiet in two decades, and then sought to have his article
He replied edited. To that criticism. Sorry to interrupt. He did reply to that criticism and said, well, they were before October the 7th. Ignoring
yeah, except they weren't, and it didn't take a degree in rocket science to see a crisis coming, which you would expect at least that someone who has assumed the post of national security advisor of the most powerful state in history would have at least an inkling. I mean, the problem here is that we're not talking about Saudi-Israeli normalization. What we're really talking about is a tripartite Saudi-Israeli-US deal, which from Washington's perspective, and certainly from Israel's as well, is intended not to promote Israeli-Palestinian peace, but to promote Israeli unilateralism, to enable further Israeli unilateralism vis-a-vis the Palestinians, and to completely crush and marginalize the Palestinians. Washington's problem is that for Saudi Arabia, the real prize in such an agreement is not anything it would get from Israel, but what it would get from the United States. And all indications are is that the Biden administration would not be able to obtain congressional approval for either a formal security guarantee for Saudi Arabia or a civilian nuclear program that it would provide to Saudi Arabia. So in my view, this agreement was never really going to materialize anyway. And as you may recall, a month or two ago, the Saudis, voicing their increasing frustration with the Israelis and Israel's intransigence, suggested to put the Israeli component of this deal on ice and proceed with the bilateral U.S.-Saudi components of it. And the U.S., of course, said, well, if there's nothing in it for Israel, we're not interested, even though the bilateral U.S.-Saudi deal would have great advantages for the U.S. strategic position in the region.
The Biden administration not so interested then in U.S. Interests, it appears. Meanwhile, on Monday, there's a BRICS foreign ministers meeting and the foreign ministers of UAE and Saudi are in Russia. And the king of Bahrain was in Moscow the other day. I mean, what do you think? Removal of U.S. bases from this region? Are people discussing that? I bet the Russians and the Chinese do. How does Qatar host Hamas and the biggest, one of the biggest U.S. bases, Al Udeid base, and run Al Jazeera, and Bahrain have a huge U.S. base and increasingly be tied to countries that are critical of the genocide?
Well, I think what we've been seeing in many of these GCC states and also other states in the region like Egypt, for example, certainly during the past decade, is it's not so much a rupture in their relations with their traditional patron in Washington and finding new ones in Russia or China, but rather what I would call a process of strategic diversification. In other words, for many of these states, their primary strategic relationship remains with the United States. They continue to look to Washington as the ultimate guarantor of their security, but at the same time, they are also developing increasingly close economic, security, and even strategic relations with the Russians and with the Chinese, both as an insurance policy and in order to also reduce what had previously been a complete dependence on Washington. So there's a process of of diversification going on rather than, let's say, changing one patron for another.
You know, just finally, Matthew Miller, that State Department spokesperson that does press conferences, said he hadn't seen the picture of the beheaded baby after the massacre in Rafah in the past few days. It's not only the anniversary of the publication of Orwell's 1984, it's 52 years since the famous photo of a 9-year-old Phanthi Kim Phuc burned by US chemical weapons, WMD, in Vietnam. Why is it, despite all the money, maybe it's an eternal question about elite classes, are these congressmen and women and all these members of parliament in Western European capitals, say in Germany, which is supplying so much of the weaponry that's raining down on Gaza, why are they not as appalled as the world was from seeing what the United States were doing to the babies and children of Vietnam as we are seeing to the Arabs of Palestine?
Well, Matthew Miller, of course, is a personification of see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil when it comes to Israel and its genocidal policy. He's, I mean, even by the standards of apparatchiks, whose role it is to make apologia for their government's policies, he's really in a class of his own, him and his colleagues. But regarding your question, I think maybe
not to leave Admiral Kirby out of it. Sorry, but yeah, go on.
No, no, definitely don't leave Kirby out of it. He's right up there with Miller. But getting back to your question, I think we need to get away from this view which looks at Western politicians as somehow being bought by the Israelis or being blackmailed by the Israelis or being threatened by the Israelis, and blindly embracing Israel against their better judgment or against their will. And perhaps we should start looking at these people as doing precisely what they want to do, as people who are fundamentally racist, who feel that Israel is entitled to do whatever it pleases with the Palestinian people, with the Arabs, and with the region for that matter. And these are people who almost congenitally have been conditioned to view Palestinians and Arabs as irrelevant and expendable human scum. So it's not that they don't see these images, but that these images make absolutely no impression on them. They couldn't care less.
Muin Rabbani, thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those bereaved by UK-US-EU armed genocide. We'll be back on Monday to focus on the nuclear-armed eye in BRICS, which just had elections with a former advisor to India's National Security Council. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday.